explorations of the character of God. God is omniscient. This is one of several attributes that's prefixed by the, I suppose, the prefix omni. Looked at one last week and looking at one next week with Andrew, God willing. The word omni is very much, it's taken from a Latin word, omnis. And that means all. And in this particular case, the word omniscient is actually taken from a Latin word that means scientior, which is scientior, and that means the word knowledge. So omniscient, all knowledge. And that really simply means that if God has all knowledge, then God knows everything. And God knows everything perfectly. And everything that God knows perfectly, he also knows absolutely exhaustively. So God knows all things. He knows all things perfectly, and he knows all things exhaustively. He knows everything there is on every particular subject. There is absolutely nothing that is hidden from the sight of God. That's past, present, or future. God knows all the past, all the present, and all the future equally well, and all in front of him at that point in time. Even in terms of God's union and his communion as the triune God, God knows all things. The Father knows the Son perfectly and exhaustively. The Son knows the Spirit perfectly and exhaustively. And in the communion of the Father and the Son in the Spirit not only knows the Father and Son exhaustively, but he also knows the Father's relationship with the Son and the Son's relationship with the Father exhaustively. There is nothing in God that is hidden from God, and there is nothing outside of God in all what we may describe as God's external works that is hidden from his sight and his knowledge. Psalm 139, it's the passage I'm really going to use to try and open this passage up, is where the writer speaks predominantly of the omniscience of God. He doesn't do it from any sort of philosophical debate, but he does it simply because, I'd suggest, he's just taken up, as he reflects, as he thinks about the absolute enormity of the glory of God. And he's aware that the covenant God, his covenant God, knows all things. And I'd suggest from when we read through the passage, in particular, that he actually knows all things about him, about David. The psalm, of course, does speak of other attributes. Verses 7 to 11, I'll mention the word, but nothing else for Andrew. For the omnipresence of God, Andrew will explain all that to us next week. So I'm going to leave them verses out. Verse 14 speaks about another attribute of God, the power of God. Verses 19 to 22, I think it is, very much speaks about the holiness of God. And there's other attributes that are clearly referred to. But I think the thread that holds this psalm together is actually the psalmist's amazement at our subject for tonight, the omniscience of God. The perfect, exhaustive knowledge of God. And there's four things we're going to look at. Firstly, the universality of God's knowledge. First six verses, the universality of God's knowledge. It's interesting, it's not always wrong to begin with ourselves. That's exactly what David does here. He begins with himself in relationship to God. Verse 1, O Lord, you have searched me and you know me. And then he reflects on just how that is true. In verse 2, you know when I sit and when I stand. You perceive my thoughts from afar. He's almost saying the rhythms, the routines of daily life. David's probably thinking, I can't remember each time I sat down. I can't remember each time I stood up. I can't remember all the places I've been to and when I went and when I came back and what route I took and all those sort of things. But then he stops and he thinks, but God. God has perfect knowledge of all those, well, what were for me incidental, trivial, everyday events. I can't remember them. But God does know them. But then in verse 3, notice his knowledge, God's knowledge, goes actually deep. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Everything that David does, God is familiar with. God has knowledge of. God knows that. And then in verse 4, before, not after, before a word is on my tongue, you know it completely, O Lord. Even the undisclosed thoughts of David's mind, the undisclosed thoughts and feelings of his heart, those things that perhaps David is just beginning to think about, his brain hasn't had a chance yet to put it into words, let alone for it to get down to his tongue and come out in sound. And David said, you know them. You know my words even before they reach my tongue. Because you've got perfect, complete, exhaustive knowledge. And David realises that this would be absolutely immense if all God had to do was focus on one person. It would be incredible if God was able to do that just for David. But what's really mind-blowing for David is it's not just for David. It's for every human being who has ever lived. God has all knowledge about every human being in all ages, at all times, perfectly there in front of him when he needs it. Let alone of all the sparrows that fall to the ground and everything else. And that's why, as a believer, in verse 6, he speaks so sweetly of the knowledge of God. Such knowledge
it's just too wonderful for me.
It's too lofty for me to attain. It's blowing my mind. I just can't get my head around it. Even when I just think about your knowledge of me, it's too much for me. It's too wonderful. It's too vast for me to get my head round. We read from Psalm 131, and it's almost when we read through those verses, it's as if David's responding to the way that he began Psalm 131. My heart is not proud, O Lord. My eyes are not haughty. I do not concern myself with great matters or things too wonderful for me. He's saying, my comfort, my trust, my reliance is to rest in your perfect knowledge. That's why he could go on to say in verse 2, but I have stilled and quietened my soul, like a weaned child with its mother. Like a weaned child is my soul within me. Saying, I'm at peace because you know all things. The believer, the Christian, who grasps the omniscience of God can rest in that through all the storms of life. Whatever befalls us, to know with absolute certainty God knows all things. God knows my circumstances at this point, and I can trust him. Just one very simple illustration. How do you think the Lord Jesus slept in that boat during the storm on the Sea of Galilee, when all around were flapping? He knew that his Father knows all things. Secondly, it's verses 7 to 15, the immensity of God's knowledge. As I said, verses 7 to 10, they reflect on the omnipresence of God. We're not going to look at them tonight. But in that context, the context of what David writes in verses 7 to 10, he goes on to speak about the immensity of God's knowledge. Verses 11 and 12. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me, and the light become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you. What the writer is saying there is, God's knowledge is not dependent upon light. I think what God is saying, to put it into perhaps more simple language that we can understand, is this. Is that God is not dependent upon sensory experience like we are through our five senses. God's knowledge is not dependent. It doesn't come to him like our knowledge comes to us through our five senses. The language that's being used there is very much, I suppose, from Genesis chapter 1. What it's actually saying is this: God knew everything, God knows everything without the light of creation. I don't know if any of you have ever lived in a really rural area. You've got to live a number of miles, quite a few miles, away from any town or city. But if you've ever lived in a rural area, particularly if it's a cloudy night, no stars, and you put your hand like that, you can't see it. That's darkness. I remember once we were on holiday, it was on the Isle of Skye. And I went out one night, and I only walked a few yards, and it was like that. Pitch black, there wasn't a star in the sky. I just couldn't see anything. If I looked in that distance, there was one street light, but it was miles away. But when I turned round, the cottage we were stopping at, it was nowhere near as far away from me as what the back wall is. I couldn't see it. It was that dark. That's darkness. Now, the psalmist is not saying here, God's got good eyesight. He can see in the dark. You know, we might say to children, you know, eat carrots, they'll help you see in the dark. Now, it's not saying, listen, God's got really good eyesight in the dark. But what it is saying is this: whether it is light or dark, whether there is creation or no creation, God's knowledge is perfect. Light and dark, creation or no creation, is actually irrelevant to God's knowledge. Now, one of the things that teaches us is that God possesses his knowledge in a very different way to the way that we possess knowledge. And he gives us, a little insight into this. Verses 13 to 15, "For you created my inmost being, you knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful, I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth." Of all God's masterpieces, God, a lot of masterpieces, but of all God's masterpieces would seem to be, David is saying, the crowning one, the best one of all, is creating a child in his own image and in his own likeness. And that he makes that child, he creates that child in the depths of the darkness. In the depths of the earth, or in the darkest place, depending what translation you're using. Now, there's a similar theme to that David speaks of in Psalm 51. "Surely I was sinful at birth. Sinful from the time my mother conceived me." From the time, David is saying, the time, God, when you began to put me together in the darkest place. What David is doing in Psalm 51 is he is recognising that his sin goes back to the very beginning of his existence. It's actually part of his fallen identity. He's saying that even when God put me together in my mother's womb, even then he knew me through and through. Even then, he knew everything there is to know about me at that point in time. Now, if you recognise your sinfulness, if you recognise you're a sinner before God, and you know God's forgiveness in your life, you recognise that you need to have somebody who understands you completely, then I'd suggest that this truth to you, the immensity of God's knowledge, is not just a wonderful truth, but it's also a great comfort. Thirdly, just verse 16, the incomparability of God's knowledge. "Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. One of the things it's wrong to assume is that God simply amassed his knowledge, that he's got more knowledge than us. That over the years God simply has simply been able to amass a vast amount of knowledge, infinitely more than us. God's got a bigger brain than us, therefore he can amass more knowledge. It's not about that. What we need to grasp, besides the enormity of God's knowledge, is the fact that God's whole way of knowing things is actually very different to ours. And verse 16 gives us a hint about this. What David is saying in verse 16 is this: my unformed substance, my unlived days, even that was fully and completely known by God. What the psalmist is saying is that God's knowledge of this world is entirely independent of this world for its existence. Just think for a minute how our knowledge comes to us. Our knowledge comes to us. There are some things that it just drip, drip, drip. It comes gradually. It maybe comes over hours, weeks, months, maybe over years. There's other things that our knowledge comes to us like that. In a moment, it comes instantly. We see something, we just grasp it straight away. Put your hand on, if you're in the electric cooker, put your hand on one of the rings when it's on. Knowledge will come to you straight away. Guaranteed. But whether it comes to us gradually, or whether it comes to us instantly, one of the things we're dependent on is the object of our knowledge existing. God isn't. His knowledge doesn't depend upon the object of his knowledge already existing in any form. We know things because the things we know are, they have their being, and in one way of the or another, they disclose themselves to us through our five senses. That doesn't apply to God. For God, things exist, and they are, and they have their being, not in order for God to know them, which is the case for us, but because he already knows them. God knows everything out of his own sovereign purposes and plans. Whether it's to do with creation, God knows everything. Whether it's to do with providence, the things that happen in our lives, whether it's to do with what we call eschatology, the last times, or whether it's to do with beyond that, glory itself. All those things and all the things that happen within them things, they do so, they come to pass because God has known them and because God has spoken them into existence or into happening. I suppose we can't hear these things or think about these things without asking a question. The question is this: if all things are necessary because God knows them, does that mean that God, in his knowledge of all things, determines that all things come to pass? And if you think about it, that takes us right to the very heart of the Bible's teaching of what one writer described as the absolute omniscience of the absolutely sovereign God. That if all things are necessary because God knows them, does that mean that God, in his knowledge of all things, determines, decrees, that all things must come to pass? I suppose that's a great question, isn't it, that flows from what I'll describe as classical Reformed teaching. Another one that goes with it is this: how can we reconcile the absolute sovereignty of God with our individual human free will? Well, I suppose in a sense we can't, can we? Bible teaches both are true, but we can't reconcile them. Perhaps the best response belongs to Martin Luther. He just said this: let God be God. That's perhaps the best response we can have to those huge questions that are so difficult for us to get our heads around. We know that they are true. God has perfect knowledge. God has perfect knowledge, past, present and future. Does God decree all things because of that knowledge? And how do we reconcile God's sovereignty? That if God does decree all things, well, how do you reconcile that with what the Bible teaches of human free will, human responsibility? Let God be God. Fourth and lastly, the practicality of God's knowledge, verses 17 to 24. Do you ever reflect on the fact that all these things that are true about God, these immense, amazing things, whether it's to do with the omniscience of God or many other things, we all believe they're true, but God actually could have chosen never to reveal them to us? So why has he told us of these things? Well, I think the psalmist gives us a clue here. He reflects on this from the perspective of them being such a blessing to individual Christians. I've just put four subheadings up there. Firstly, it's verses 17 and 18. They give the believer security. The psalmist is sure he's not just been dreaming these things up. He's absolutely certain of them. He's sure that these are real truths. And because he's sure that these are real truths, I hope we're sure that they're real truths as well. One benefit they can be to us is simply this: they can mean that a Christian can lay their head on a pillow at night, and I say this with reverence, they can say good night to God, and they can rest in perfect peace because God has perfect knowledge. And they can know that when their eyes open in the morning, God will still be there. That's one of the reasons why Jesus, in the Sermon on the Mount, he said, your Father knows what you need before you even ask him. That's our refuge. That's our resource. So the omniscience of God ought to be a blessing to us in the midst of anxiety, let alone when we just go to sleep at night. Secondly, it deals with our iniquity. Verses 19 and verse 22. The psalmist is very aware that God knows who the people are that he's talking about in those verses. Those who rebel against God, those who hate God, those who seek to do the gospel harm, the message of God harm, the people of God harm. David's aware, God knows exactly who they are. And he's aware that because of God's omniscience, because of God's perfect knowledge, he knows every detail about their wickedness. Therefore, he can leave it in God's hands. There's no need, there's no reason for David to need to take revenge himself. Because he knows he can leave things in God's hands. Because God knows all things. Thirdly, it calls us to what I'll call spiritual integrity. It's verses 23 and 24. Imagine being so entrusted to God that you can say, God knows me through and through, and God has let me know that he knows me through and through. And I have complete peace with that. That's a wonderful position to be in. God does know everything about us. And God has let us know in his word that he knows everything about us. That ought to be a call to spiritual integrity. It's interesting how right at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus speaks about those who profess so much, but actually possess so little. Depart from me. I never knew you. Why did Jesus say, I never knew you? Why didn't he say, you never knew me? The reason for that is this, because the way we come to know God is a way that calls for us to be known by him through and through. There's no contradiction in what Jesus said with this doctrine of God's omniscience. God knows everything there is to know about a believer and also an unbeliever. But to be known by God in a saving way is the unique privilege of a true believer. That's why the real question is not, does God know everything about me? Well, God does know everything about me, whether I'm a believer or whether I've no interest in the things of God. The question, as Jesus made very clear to these individuals, one of the most solemn verses in the Bible, is not, do I know God? But does God know me in a saving way? Calls us to spiritual integrity. And lastly, close with this, it leads us to what I've called doxology. Verse 6, such knowledge is too wonderful for me, it's too lofty for me to attain. Imagine poor David, his head almost wanting to explode, just thumping as he's trying to think, he's trying to get his head around these things, almost crying out, God, it's too much. But then crying out, God, you're too good to me. It's not just the knowledge is too much, but your amazing goodness is too good to me as well. The end of verse 17, how vast is the sum of them. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. The end of verse 24, that prayer, and lead me
in the way everlasting. That's how we ought to end, isn't it? Lord, lead me in the way everlasting. It's interesting how Tim read this to us this morning, how at the end of the day, Peter was able to say this: Lord, you know all things, and you know that I love you. Well, may that be true of us all, that we can say, Lord, you know all things. That bit's certain. May we be able to say this: Lord, and you know that I love you. Because it's then that we can take real comfort in the omniscience of God, the perfect, complete, exhaustive knowledge of God. Amen.